GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We are live for the Stopover Music Festival. We're broadcasting from The Gray in Savannah, and the music you've heard is from Christopher Paul Stelling and his band. Chris plays in the festival tomorrow. We'll talk to him later in the show. Playing with him is Matt Murphy on upright bass and Kieran Ledwidge on fiddle. But if you're in Savannah this weekend, we want to know who you're excited to see. Here's some of what some folks at the festival had to say.
I'm Carrie Grayson. Probably my favorite is Vagabond. Like, I'm so excited about seeing Vagabond and Tim Darcy from Ought.
My name is Alex. I'm really excited to see Lee Fields and The Expression.
Caitlin Langdon. I am super excited that the Cusses are now back and playing. That's probably my top show to go see. They're good people. It's a good band.
Sarah Whiteman. Probably A Tribe Called Red. Lee Fields. Kishibashi. Major of the Mombacks. McLeod. Obviously them.
So who is your favorite band to see live? Who is worth seeing in concert? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You know how to tweet us. It's at OST Talk or email us. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. The Port of Savannah leads the nation in exports of shark fins, chiefly to parts of Asia. It's legal to sell shark fins, but controversial. The fins are used almost exclusively for shark fin soup, and harvesting just that fin kills the shark. Just cutting the fin off and throwing the shark back, though, is a federal offense. I talked about this with Mary Landers, reporter for Savannah Morning News, and also joining us was Lori Snyder, shark campaign director for the nonprofit group Oceana.
Laura, how many shark fins are we talking about? How many sharks, I assume they die when you remove their fin, but how many sharks are being killed?
Yeah, the fins from as many as 73 million sharks make it into the global shark fin trade every year. And that is part of the reason that 25% of shark species and their relatives are threatened with extinction.
Why, Mary, Savannah? Why is Savannah topping the list for these exports?
So it's a new thing that Savannah is topping the list. In previous years, Savannah was not on the list at all. And then beginning in 2014, we started to see more exports going out of Savannah because other states banned the export.
And how many? She just said 73 million, I think, Laura, per year?
Yes, the fins from as many as 73 million sharks make it into the global shark fin trade every year.
How many of those, Mary, come from Savannah?
So this gets tricky about the number of shark fins. What we know from data from the National Marine Fisheries Service is the poundage and the value of those shark fins. And what we're talking about is $600,000 worth of shark fins coming out of Savannah last year. I forget the poundage. It's
It's a little over 20,000 pounds from 2016.
So, Mary, this has been controversial, and not just worldwide, but here in Georgia as well. They did try to pass legislation that would regulate this, did they not?
I know that there was a petition requesting that legislation. I don't know where that petition went.
That was the one signed by the Georgia Aquarium, you mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Laura, that goes to you because some members of Congress have proposed just not doing this, exporting shark fins from the United States anymore. Why didn't that legislation pass?
Well, in the last couple of years, 11 states have actually passed legislation to ban the buying and selling of shark fins in the United States. And that's part of the reason why we've seen that the export market has shifted out of Savannah. So last year, a number of bipartisan members of Congress, towards the end of Congress, introduced legislation that would ban the buying and selling, imports and exports of shark fins in the United States. And that effort continues to be underway, and we continue to get more and more support for a national ban on the imports, exports, buying, and selling of shark fins in the United States. So the United States will really be a leader in fighting this global trade.
Although right now the U.S. is the largest exporter of shark fins, correct?
The United States is the largest exporter of shark fins from the Western Hemisphere.
I see. And these aren't all going to Asia. The U.S. also imports shark fins.
Yeah, the United States. So the act of shark finning, which is when you cut off the fins off a shark and then dump the body back into the ocean, leaving it to die, often a painful and pretty brutal death, that has been illegal in the United States since 2000. However, we still continue to import and export shark fins into the United States. And in fact, over 80% of the shark fins that are being imported into the United States come from countries that do not have similar finning bans in place.
Now, the headline, Mary, on your piece was Savannah leads controversial trade in shark fins. How is that controversy playing out in Savannah? Are people aware of the export of shark fins from the port, and are they talking about it?
Well, before this story, I was not aware that there was a shark fin trade going out of the port of Savannah, so I don't think it was very high profile. The story did get a lot of good play, so there are more people. We got some responses online, actually universally, you know, disgusted with the idea of shark finning. But as Laura points out, the shark finning is already illegal in the U.S. So that's as far as it's gotten in Savannah.
Yeah, and there is a difference between shark finning, which, as you say, is illegal here, and, you know, gathering a shark much like you would any other fish to make shark fin soup. Is it accurate, Laura, to say that most of these fins are used for soup?
Yes, that is accurate. And the comparison that we like to make is that just as the demand for ivory has really jeopardized elephant populations, it's this demand for fins that are significantly impacting shark populations. And in fact, when you look at the most popular species in the global shark fin trade, over 70% of those species are at high risk or very high risk of extinction.
Where, Mary, are these sharks being caught?
So not necessarily off the coast of Georgia. And we know that probably because, and Laura can speak to this more, but you know, because the trade was going out of other ports before, it suggests that, it just shifted to here. So those sharks are being caught elsewhere, coming to Savannah for export because we don't have a ban on export here. And, you know, the Georgia coastline is not terrifically long, at 100 miles or so. It's not a huge fishery here.
Yes, in fact, I'll add to that. In 2015, the total value of shark landings for the commercial shark fishery in Georgia was only $370. So these fins are coming from other states like Florida and North Carolina and Louisiana to be shipped out of Savannah. So Georgia, is not contributing of catching sharks in their waters and sending them over. But they are, Savannah is the port where they're all exiting out of now.
And that, of course, is the argument, is that the sharks aren't being caught here. And if they ban just the shark fin business, it just means that exporters will use another port, Laura.
Exactly. So Texas passed a ban back in 2015, and part of the reason that they ended up passing the ban is that they noticed, as all these other states had banned the buying and selling of shark fins, the export market shifted to Texas. And then Texas did a ban and it went into effect in the summer of last year. And so after April of last year, now all of the fins are going out of Savannah. So it's this game of whack-a-mole. As each state passes a ban, then the market is changing. And so that is why we think it is so important and so critical that the federal government step in and pass a national ban.
Mary, do you expect to be looking at some of the other exports going through Savannah? Do you expect to be having more reports on perhaps more controversial trade or exports coming into the port or out of the port?
It's certainly something that we would be interested in. If it's brought to our attention, if I'm looking at something like this, sharks are interesting to people, and certainly everything that happens at the port is interesting to people in Savannah. I should note that the amount of the value of the shark fins that went out of Savannah last year at, I think it was $600,000 by the end of the year, $600,000. That is a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the export value value out of Savannah. I think the total was 27 or 28 billion with a B of exports. So $500,000 or $600,000 is a very small portion of that trade. Although, as Oceana rightly points out, Savannah was the leader in exporting shark
the
fins.
Implication being that if they were to ban the export of shark fins from Savannah's port, it wouldn't have much impact on business or profits.
Yes.
So, Laura, where does this stand at this point? You say that there's a federal bill coming forward. Would that federal bill apply to every single port, or would states and local municipalities have more control?
It would apply to every state and to ports. It would ban the buying and selling, importing and exporting of shark fins in the United States. So here is one reason why it is so important. California has a ban, but because it is just a state ban, that fins are still being imported into California. But because of interstate commerce, that if those fins, that final address is outside of California, then they can go to, let's say, Nevada. And so we have support from the California Fish and Wildlife Commission saying, you know, yes, a federal bill is really needed now to just get the United States out of the global shark fin trade, and then could put the United States in a good position to go to other countries and say, we really need to be tackling this trade and should urge other countries to pass similar bans.
Do you find your job harder, Laura, as the shark campaign director than it would be, say, for a cute, fuzzy animal like a penguin or a seal?
So people are starting to love sharks. You know, I often say, you know, so many people are scared of sharks, but really we should be scared for sharks. Sharks have been around since the dinosaurs, and it's now human activities that are jeopardizing these populations the most. And so you have different TV programming and different organizations that I think sharks are starting to get a little bit more love.
Laura Snyder is the Shark Campaign Director for the nonprofit group Oceana. We've been talking about the controversial shark fin trade. At this point, Savannah is the leader in U.S. exports in that trade. And Mary Landers is the reporter that reported on that for the Savannah Morning News. Mary and Laura, thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We are live in Savannah at the Gray Restaurant. There's a lot more coming. We'll talk to our in-house musician, Christopher Paul Stelling, and head into the break room. But for now, more music from Chris and his band. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We are broadcasting live from Savannah for the Stopover Music Festival. You just heard the music of singer-songwriter Christopher Paul Stelling. Playing with him today is Kieran Ledwidge on fiddle, Matt Murphy on bass, playing the heck out of those instruments. Chris grew up in Daytona Beach, Florida. He is now based in Brooklyn.
Asheville, North Carolina.
He's now based in Asheville, North Carolina. Breaking news. His debut album was called Songs of Praise and Scorn. It was released in 2012. Since then, he's released two more records and performed at the NPR Music Department for a Tiny Desk concert. And he performs tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Trinity United Church and joins me now. Hi there.
Seven or eight?
Seven.
Get there at seven.
Tell me first about your instrument. I want to quote NPR. They described it as a beat-to-hell 64 Gibson gut string classical guitar.
Yeah, that one's in the back of the van. I'm playing a different one today. It doesn't get up this early.
Your classical guitar doesn't get up this early.
Yeah.
But what do you like about it?
It's got six strings and it's made out of wood.
But you've had it for a long time.
Yeah.
You're attached to it.
No, it's in the van.
No. Okay.
It was the only thing I had for a long time, guitar-wise. When I moved to New York City 10 years ago, I just went up there with a guitar and kind of made a little career for myself. And I used that opportunity to get a lot more guitars, so I'm trying to share the love a little bit and spread it around.
So what do you look for when you're trying to find musicians to collaborate? What is necessary to play with Christopher Paul Stelling?
They have to be independently wealthy and, not a lot of goals. hopefully they come from a good family that they can call when they're in a time of distress.
But seriously.
I'm absolutely serious. No, I mean, these guys, I mean, it's... I did this completely solo for many years, and I'm just starting to open myself up to the possibility of even playing with others because when you have one mouth to feed, it's a lot easier. Now I got three, and it's...
Do they eat a lot?
They do a lot. It's always lobster and filet mignon with these guys. You know, they're getting expensive. You know.
But on the other hand, I wonder about that transition of going from a solo artist who has such a passionate presence and voice alone, and how that works out musically when you are then collaborating with musicians who have their own voice.
I have no idea. We just take one day at a time. And put one foot in front of the other, and we wake up and rehearse a little bit, and we just try to take it easy. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. Let's just, I'm just figuring it all out.
That sounds like a life philosophy.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So, how is touring for you?
I do it a lot.
Yes. Yeah, and there seems to be the type of musician that thrives in tours, and the type of musician that dreads them. Mm-hmm. Which do you think that you are?
I'm a recovering former, and I'm moving into the latter.
So you're learning to love them?
No, I'm learning to hate them.
I see.
I used to love them, and I'm not. I don't hate anything. I mean, last year we did 287 shows in 15 different countries.
There's only 365 days in a year.
I know, and I was, a friend of mine said, "Well, what were you doing the other 70 days of the year?"
Traveling,
driving, <I assume. laughs> flying and driving. We ended the tour last year a week before Christmas in Sardinia, and I never thought I would have gone to Sardinia.
How was it?
It was fantastic. People all over the world are great. We have to do. We did such a good job as Americans for such a long. No, actually, we didn't.
Your whole band is not American.
We thought we were doing a good job, setting a great example for the rest of the world, and now we're certain that we're not. So we have to. We really got to clean up our act a little bit,
Do you find that the touring interferes with the writing process?
No.
No, you're still writing as much as ever?
I wake up and there's songs on a piece of paper, and I just go into the studio and record them. I don't really like.
Wait, you're writing songs in your sleep?
Yeah, pretty much. I wake up and I put a tooth under my pillow, and when I wake up, there's a song under it. They're not my teeth. I keep a collection. I go to the butcher and ask, $10, you can get probably 10 or 20 teeth.
Oh, I was going to say, let that be a warning not to be in Christopher Paul Stelling's house when night falls, because you'll lose your teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The band are all wearing dentures. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. No, you were asking what it takes to collaborate with other musicians.
They have to be willing to give up their teeth.
They have to have a lot of teeth.
Right.
Yep. So, like a shark, rows of teeth that pop out like Pez out of a Pez dispenser.
Right, but sharks regrow them.
Right.
So.
That shark thing is horrible, isn't it?
It is not nice for the sharks.
I just want everybody in Savannah to know that they're not serving shark fin soup here at the Gray.
And, that is correct. Yes.
I mean, I have some out in the van.
Have you eaten shark fin soup?
I have not, but I ate horse recently.
How was that? Was it in Sardinia?
It was in Sardinia.
I don't know how I knew that.
I was drunk.
Oh, okay. Moving on from that.
Yeah.
How have the songs changed since becoming successful? I mean, has it changed the what you're writing about?
As soon as I'm successful, I'll let you know.
And, come on.
I'll let you know. Everything that you go through, you know, it used to be, oh man, if I just, you always want a little bit more. You know, I thought years ago, if I was touring the world and I had a record label and I was doing this for a living, I would be set. That would be it. That's all I would ever need. And then you get you get what you need, and then you're like, well, if I only knew now.
If I only knew that my band members would be so hungry.
If I only had a, you know, maybe I can, maybe if I only had a house, or if I only had, right. With every accomplishment comes a new set of responsibilities and obstacles. And that's
and the bar keeps
and
moving.
Thank God for that. You know, otherwise we'd get bored.
Sure, fair enough. And then you'd be writing songs about being bored.
Yeah, or watching TV. I don't know. There's a lot to write songs about right now. This is NPR, right?
It is.
If there's any Republicans listening, I'd like to speak to you.
And that's about all the time that we have. That is musician Christopher Paul Stelling. He performs in the Savannah Stopover Festival tomorrow night at 7 p.m., Chris, at Trinity United Church, in-house musician for the hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As you said, we are live from the Gray. Want to say thank you also to his band members, the incredible musicians Kieran Ledwidge, fiddle, and Matt Murphy on upright bass. And you know what? It has been a long week, aren't they all? We talked this week with the creators of the Cartoon Network's Samurai Jack Show. We took a bite into Georgia's craft chocolate movement. And we talked about the wage gap between men and women. So it's time. We've gathered a group of smart people to reflect back on the week's news. Time for the break room.
The President of the United States does not have the authority to unilaterally order the wiretapping of an American citizen.
It is a new day for soccer in the South. It is a wonderful opportunity for one of the best teams over the last few years to spoil the party.
Bonjour.
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 Bonjour. There goes the baker with his tray like full waves. The same old bread and rolls to sell.
It is a statewide break room today. Joining me at the Gray Restaurant, our Connect Savannah community editor, Jessica Lee Libos. Nice
Good
to see
morning.
Your face for once.
It's, right, exactly. It's wonderful to be here.
And Savannah Magazine editor, Amy Condon. Hello,
Hello.
Amy.
Hello, good morning.
And
thanks
hopefully in our Atlanta studios is Commissioner Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Celeste. They're actually letting me sit in your chair today, so I'm feeling the power.
Ooh. Okay, don't do anything I wouldn't do. Joining us by Skype is veteran John Jackson, who runs a farm in Milledgeville. Hi there, John.
How's it going, guys?
It's going well. Welcome to everyone. All right, well, we might as well dive into it. Over the weekend, President Trump accused former President Obama of wiretapping his phones. He gave no evidence to back that up. And here is Republican Senator U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina speaking on CNN.
The current president has accused the former president of basically wiretapping his campaign. One of the ways you could do that legally is obtain a warrant from a federal judge. It'd have to be probable cause that the Trump campaign was up to some nefarious activity with the Russians or somebody else. If there is no warrant, that excludes that possibility.
So my question is, what do you want to happen now? Let's actually start with you, John, in Milledgeville. What do you want the next step to be?
Well, I say we wait and see how this pans out. You know, after all, you know, investigation was conducted while Trump was running for president. So why wouldn't Trump be subjected to wiretapping, especially if the allegations are directly against him? And let's remember, you know, that Eric Snowden is on the run for exposing that Americans, you know, are being wiretapped. So it's not something new. And, you know, Trump may have a genuine right to feel this way. So I just want to wait to see, you know, how this all pans out.
Steve, what do you think?
Well, we've got a problem. There's no doubt about it. And the person who's really in the catbird's, in the hot seat, I should say, is James Comey, the FBI director. The Democrats are furious with him. The Republicans are furious with him. Then you've got the Department of Justice, which Senator Graham was right. The Department of Justice would have to file for that FISA warrant, not the president. But you had Loretta Lynch meeting with Bill Clinton in a private setting, you know, during the campaign. You had the Secret Service going after Representative Jason Chaffetz after he had talked about the Secret Service misbehaving. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but there's an incredible amount of mistrust. And I think the best way to do it is go ahead and investigate it.
With the Special Prosecutor, Jessica and Amy, what do you think?
I agree with the Special Prosecutor that you bring in someone independent the way that Janet Reno did with Bill Clinton. Just immediately said, had the courage to say, look, recuse myself, let's bring in an independent person to investigate these allegations.
Jessica, what do you want to happen?
Well, I mean, what do I want to happen? I mean, a special prosecutor, why aren't we really investigating the Russian ties with Donald Trump? Why, this is all a distraction.
But I think that's what would happen.
I should say that there actually is an open investigation open in the FBI that continues.
But in accusing Obama of wiretapping the president during the campaign, or he wasn't president yet, the campaigning during the campaign. I mean, you know, obviously, don't you read WikiLeaks? They're watching us through our TVs anyway, so.
Forget about the phones.
Yeah, I'm like, what is this, 1973?
All right,
but I think if you can take the emotion out of it and put, you know, there's like three outcomes that could happen.
Right,
you know?
But they all require investigation. All right, since we're talking about wiretapping, of any new book, an educational psychologist says the key to spying on your teenager is to let them know that you're doing it. So here's the thing. Is it okay to spy on your kids? And should you inform them that you're doing it? Or does informing them make them better at hiding what they're doing?
Oh, well, since I have a 17-year-old who would
love...
Yes, I have two teenagers who try to hide things from me on social media all the time. I will say that I let them know that I'm watching them, and yet they still manage to, you know, Snapchat, so I don't, you know, I think that that's where they are most of the time, because I'm looking at their Instagram accounts going, well, everything looks very
their
clean.
Their real Instagram account,
right,
or their fake Instagram
account?
So
the fake Insta, the Finsta accounts, they, you know, somehow they still leave them open.
That's where they put the twerking videos.
Exactly.
John, what about you? Do you think it's okay?
Oh, absolutely. You know, back in the day, you know, we used the word of God to scare kids into doing right. And, you know, I think teens are going to find the path of least resistance to, you know, to do the dirt. And I think it's crafty to use psychological warfare on teens who are obviously smarter than their parents, because we know all teens are smarter than their parents. And we have a saying in special operations that, you know, the best use of force is the show of force. And it really works.
Steve, what do you think?
Well, I think spying is the wrong term to use, and I would like to see parents, and this is what I do with my children. My youngest child is now a freshman in college, so every one of the apps that came along happened during my children's lifespan. So we sat there and we talked about a lot of the dangers, and you rationalize with your children and say, look, this is the potential danger. This is what can happen. We'd like to be part of this. And then you try to stay out of their digital life as much as you can. Don't post. Don't make yourself present on any of the social apps, and just kind of watch things. And if you see something, you bring it up. And that's the best way to go.
Something.
Do any of y'all use the parental controls on anything?
You know,
my son knows how to get around those.
It seems like that those are mostly for the parents to feel better.
Okay.
They don't agree. Yeah.
My stepson is so much older. I didn't have to go through any of this.
Oh, I see.
Although I was clued in enough to go, I know what you're up to.
Right, Buster. It is Friday. We're in the break room. We're coming to you live from the Gray in Savannah. Just ahead, we'll talk about why Americans are having less sex than perhaps ever before, how you choose a college major, and the reboot of Beauty and the Beast. Our music today from musician Christopher Paul Stelling. This is On Second Thought. Fellow man, oh, the darkness I take over. This is On Second Thoughts. I'm Celeste Headlee, coming to you live from the Gray Restaurant in Savannah. We are here for the Stopover Music Festival, and we've been hearing the music of a musician, Christopher Paul Stelling, and his band, so we want to give a big thank you to them while they're still here. And we're having coffee and conversation in the break room. We do it every Friday. My guests today at the Gray are Jessica Lee Libos of Connect Savannah, Amy Condon of Savannah Magazine. In Atlanta is Steve Brown. He's a commissioner with the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, and joining us by Skype from his farm in Milledgeville is veteran John Jackson. And we want to say thank you, as we always do, to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that we usually drink every morning. They're online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, now, a report just came out that says American adults, all of them, are having less sex.
Al, let's have sex.
No pig.
Okay, the study comes from the journal Archives of Sexual Behavior. American adults had sex 9 fewer times in 2014 than they did in the late 1990s. This average yearly decline is across the board, everybody, including millennials, which seems to have surprised a number of people. It is particularly low for married couples. That is where the significant decline has come in. So, bad sign?
Well, I just have to preface it to say my husband and I are definitely at the high end. I love you, honey. You're super sexy.
Thank you to say that.
But, you know, these aren't exactly sexy times. I mean, you know, reproductive justice and birth control are under threat. I mean, mom jeans are making a comeback. I mean, you know, I mean, this isn't...
Wait,
you know,
mom jeans aren't sexy?
Pull them back out from, like, the 90s.
You know, I mean, we have so many distractions in bed. I mean,
so
you know.
She's going to blame it on the news headlines. Steve, what do you want to blame it on?
Well, you know, I would have thought in the age of Viagra and Cialis that sex would be way up on the charts because you have the ability to have sex. But even the studies show that Viagra doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get a significant increase in sexual frequency. So I think.
Well, yeah, because there's a partner on the other
yeah,
end.
Yeah, I was like, those are specifically for men.
Well, you're right. You're exactly right. Yeah. And, but I think this non-work computer usage, people spend so much time on the computer and they handle their relationships via the computer now. And there's not a lot of the physical intimacy and that's involved maybe in years past.
Well, joining us by Skype, John Jackson. Chris, our band seemed to think a lot of it to blame is the cell phone. Are we spending too much time on our cell phone and not being intimate? John?
I think you guys got it all wrong. It was an election year. Everybody's stressed out about Trump. Everybody's sitting around eating, you know, Lickies and Chewies, getting fat. So Americans just are pretty much just fat and unattractive right now.
Oh, honey, you need to speak for yourself, baby. I'm as lean and mean as I've ever been. Are you kidding me?
Jessica Lee Libos is a stone cold babe, John. Amy, what do you think?
I think Trump has made some of us women far more righteous.
I think so, too. In fact, it might be that, you know, I guess for like that the week following the election, I mean, I think my husband and his friends were a little bit scared because they were, you know, the women were rising up and they were afraid they would never get laid again. But, you know, oh God, I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to say that. But I mean,
public radio, Jessica.
Sorry, excuse me. I mean, we would be having less sex than ever. However, I think that it's risen. I think that women actually feel empowered, and it's definitely not due to Cialis or Viagra.
Okay, I'm going to, before the FCC calls, I am going to move on. It's okay. On Wednesday, Wednesday was International Women's Day. To mark the day, a Wall Street firm put up a statue of a determined young girl facing down the Wall Street bull. The company wanted to call attention to the tiny number of women who serve on boards at the largest U.S. corporation. So let me start with our women. Did it work for you?
Yes and no. I think it helped start a conversation, and it was a powerful statement that the future is female, and these younger women are going to be the ones to take this on,
yes.
Are going to inherit this from us. However, it's so temporary.
Yeah, it went up for a week.
Right, that in our distractedness with so many different pieces of information coming at us, I don't know that will be a lasting conversation. It needs to be a lasting conversation.
Jessica?
I agree. I think the temporary nature of it, you know, it was this closed-ended conversation, and it needs to be an open conversation.
you know, having a little cutesy girl there. It was a cute image, and it was impactful at the beginning. But you know, the swinging ponytail and the little tiny—it seemed almost outdated already. I mean, I would have liked to have seen a woman standing there with a briefcase.
Okay, well, let me go to John it. Because John, you might be our expert on whether or not that girl would actually have a chance against that bull. I'm thinking no. Oh. Did it work for you symbolically?
Is she with my daughter? Yes, because my daughter is a firecracker, I'll tell you that. But, you know, having served in one of the most amazing units in the world with the best leaders, you know, my opinion is that, you know, leadership should never be defined by gender or race, and either you have it or you don't. And with that being said, everybody should have the opportunity, you know, to show their craft. And me personally, I would never hire someone based on gender. They must be a subject matter expert. They have to motivate people, and they have to be a leader. So bring it. And if you're a female, you know, just bring it. That's how I feel about it.
Steve?
Well, you know, I think it is a shame that we only have 16% of the board seats in the Russell 3000 who are women. That number, I think, is going to increase coming up in the later years. I don't think it's going to reach parity by any stretch, but you've got fewer women who are marrying, fewer are having children, and you'll probably see more of them ascending up the ladder instead of looking at family type of issues.
I, Jessica and Amy yeah. are itching in their seats.
Yeah. I mean, is that an implication that getting married and having children removes you from a leadership potential?
Nor should it.
No, and I'm not saying that, but you take somebody like Marissa Mayer, for example, the CEO of Yahoo. She built a nursery adjacent to her office and things like that. I think that's a very unrealistic picture for most women in the United States. They're not going to be able to build a nursery suite next to their office or next to their cubicle. And, you know, there are family concerns. And women tend to be obviously more conscious about family concerns than men because there are a lot of men who are spending a lot of late nights in the office and not at home.
We're going to move on because I know we could stay here for the rest of the hour. We are hanging out in the break room. You have three women here ready to meet you and speak, Sean, over coffee.
That would be great.
Steve, we're in the break room. Jessica Lee Libos of Connect Savannah, Amy Condon of Savannah Magazine, Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, and Farmer John Jackson. And we have a live audience. Let's hear from you guys. We are at the Gray Restaurant in Savannah. Okay, speaking of powerful women, actress Emma Watson famously played Hermione Granger, the real star of the Harry Potter films. She, this time, is starring as Belle. Oh, I just got some dirty looks. She's starring as Belle in the live-action version of Disney's Beauty and the Beast. Let's hear a little clip.
Something sweet and almost kind, but he was mean and he was coarse and unrefined, and now he's dead. Didn't see it there before.
Okay, leaving beside the fact that she's having a relationship with a water buffalo, yes. The film cost $300 million to make. So this is a major gamble on Disney's part, and the question is, will it pay off? And Steve, let's go to you first.
Well, you know, I live right down the street from Pinewood Studios, so that's where they shoot most of the big Marvel movies, and they've been very, very successful. But you're looking at movies that have a budget of around $75 to $150 million, so $300 million is a huge chunk of change. I think Emma Watson was a perfect choice for Belle. She's got a lot of panache, and everybody likes her in from the Harry Potter film, so I think that will probably help. But I cannot see them making the money in the United States. Maybe they make it up on ticket sales abroad, but in the United States, I don't see it.
John, does your daughter want to go see it?
Yeah, I think Disney has done a great job of brainwashing my kids with that song. So, yeah.
I think Skype is letting us down there. Oh. Jessica, what do you think?
Well, we're a musical theater family, so yeah, it's kind of a no-brainer. Absolutely, we'll go. We'll probably be singing in the aisles. So.
Oh, that's right. If you go to this movie, people are going to sing along, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and again, you know, I mean, I think that it is a huge gamble. It's a very expensive movie, but think about, I mean, how many of those golden bell dresses will they now sell more of, you know? I mean, and,
you know. A lot. Okay. Let's move on to soccer. It is the world's most popular sport. Atlanta United played its first game in Atlanta last weekend. The game was slightly marred. There was a large group of fans chanting a gay slur during the game. The team issued a very stern statement, but this raises a larger question for me. How far should sports teams go to punish fans for behavior like this? I mean, should it come down to kicking a paying fan out of their seat if they're doing this stuff? Amy, let's go with you.
Yeah, I think if they're being disruptive or they're interfering with the gameplay, you know, management of a stadium has absolutely the right to go in and say, you know, leave and get out of here. And I think the team did, you know, they immediately addressed it in a statement, which, you know, a lot of teams don't necessarily do that or come and speak out. So I applaud them for that. But I think in this day and age, these things can get really out of hand really fast.
They can. And we're not going to use that gay slur on the air, just a warning.
No. I promise. Sorry.
Yes.
But I do want to say, you know, I mean, soccer worldwide has, that soccer fans worldwide have reputations for being some of the crudest and rudest. And as soccer gains in popularity in America, we have an opportunity to change the culture here. And I think it's really important that stadium owners and team owners speak out against that bad behavior immediately and engender the kind of atmosphere that we want to take our kids to, that we want to support. Good sportsmanship, you know? Let's show the world and that America can be good sports.
John, what do you think?
I agree with everyone. You know, with regards to the stadium or to the team being able to kick those guys out, it's really difficult, though, to hold everyone accountable, you know, in the stadium. Them coming out with a stern response to it was good on them. We just have to continue to remind folks that we are a tolerant country, and we're tolerant of everybody. So that message should be resonated throughout.
Okay, we have a very diverse panel this week in the break room when it comes to job. Because we've got magazine editors, we have a farmer and a former veteran, and a veteran, a county commissioner, and of course a public radio host. I will not ask how much money you all make, but it turns out the top earning job in America for the third or so year in a row is physician. Did you consider, while you were in school, did you consider the earning potential of your college major? Steve?
Clearly.
Well, you know, actually, my wife is a physician, and I can tell you it's a little bit jaded when you look at the dollar figures, because they went to school for 32 years, and then they have high overhead costs and high liability costs that none of us could imagine. So it's a little slanted, but I didn't think about income or anything like that when I was going to school. I wanted to do something that I wanted to enjoy, and I'm encouraging my children to do the same thing while they're in college.
John, what about you?
Well, they make a lot of money, but they also have a high rate of suicide, too, amongst other people in a similar type of profession. So, you know, my look at it is this, you know, I look for quality of life versus, you know, how much I can make. I'm a disabled vet. Obviously, I volunteer with my nonprofit all, you know, every day. As I talk to folks who are in business for themselves, you know, I always ask, you know, are you happy? And that's the main thing. It seems like with a lot of these physicians, depression goes unnoticed in their work, because it's a very high impact what they have to do, and a lot of lives are on the line. And I think that needs to be addressed in the overall, when we look at these type of things.
Jessica?
Well, my major was creative writing,
so no,
not at all. I was pretty sure I was going to be working in a coffee shop for the rest of my life.
Right. I'm in public radio and opera.
Yeah, there you go, exactly. But my son has announced that he would like to pursue medical school, so I'm pretty much counting on him to take care of me in my old age.
There you go. And student loans.
Yeah.
Amy?
I didn't think about the long-term financial, because I knew I needed something that would keep me engaged and be different almost every day.
Yes.
And so that's why journalism and planning were always...
Money's boring.
Well, I wasn't motivated by it, but now I'm kind of am.
All right. Well, we are out of time. We are out of time in the break room today. I want to say thank you to all my guests. Jessica Lee Libos of Connect Savannah, Amy Condon of Savannah Magazine, Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, and Farmer John Jackson. We also want to say a big thanks to the Gray Restaurant for hosting us in their beautiful facility for our live broadcast from Savannah. And a big thank you to our audience as well, getting up early to hear us talk about stuff. And special thanks to the incredible musicians who got up much earlier than musicians usually do. Christopher Paul Stelling, Matt Murphy on upright bass, Kieran Ledwidge on fiddle. You can catch them Saturday night at 7 at Savannah's Trinity United Church. The performance is part of the Stopover Music Festival. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought from GPB News, live from the Gray. Have a great weekend.
Cross the great divide.